Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Five women vying against each other.
Mountaineers who put everything on the line to follow their dreams.
To be the first to climb all 8,000 metre peaks.
The 14 highest mountains.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service presents Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Rachel Wright, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 25th of April, these are our main stories. As pro-Palestinian demonstrations spread across US university campuses, the US House Speaker demands protests must stop. President Zelensky welcomes the long-awaited US aid package to Ukraine. We ask how likely it is to change events on the ground. Also in this podcast, Portugal's surprised mea culpa as it says it wants to take full responsibility for its involvement in the slave trade. And
he said, did you go to Cardinal Allen Grammar School in Liverpool? I go, yeah. He says, James, it's me, Colin. And we just feel we've got so much catching up to do.
How reconnecting with old friends is not always easy. The ripples of the Israel-Palestinian conflict have spread across the world, causing massive demonstrations in capital cities throughout Europe. But in the US, it's taken on a new dimension, with protests at universities across the country. On Wednesday, pro-Palestinian demonstrators clashed with police at universities in Texas and California. And at Columbia University in New York, where more than 100 students were arrested at a protest encampment last week, the House Speaker, Mike Johnson, said the protest must end.
Sadly, Columbia's administrators have chosen to let the threats, the fear, and the intimidation of the mob rule, to overtake American principles like free speech and the free exchange of ideas and the free exercise of religion. They have co-opted First Amendment arguments to protect genocide and to elevate the voices of anti-Semitism. They have proven themselves to be incapable of achieving their basic responsibility, which is keeping students safe. We just can't allow this kind of hatred and anti-Semitism to flourish on our campuses, and it must be stopped in its tracks. Those who are perpetrating this violence should be arrested. And I'm here today joining my colleagues and calling on President Shafiq to resign if she cannot immediately bring order to this chaos. As Speaker of the House, I am committing today that the Congress will not be silent as Jewish students are expected to run for their lives and stay home from their classes hiding in fear.
Protests have also been happening at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. Our correspondent Emma Vardy spoke to me from there.
Well, this is a campus among a number of campuses that have seen more demonstrations today. Protesters were here in Los Angeles on campus from about 8 o'clock this morning. There were protesters who, it seemed, had put up some tents. They were asked to take those down. That led to some clashes between protesters and police. It seems one protester at least, was detained. Those did seem to calm down, though. And then for the next few hours, this demonstration has been going off pretty peacefully, although around me now there are campus police. But students I've been speaking to here say actually the protest has grown in numbers and support has been galvanised really by what's been happening elsewhere in the United States. The arrests that happened in Columbia, in Texas, have helped to, I suppose, attract more people to these protests.
We heard earlier that the House Speaker has called for the resignation of the head of Columbia University and called for protests to end. Has there been any reaction to that from where you are?
Well, pro-Palestinian activists here and students, well, they feel that free speech is being shut down. But then you have Jewish students here saying they actually feel threatened on campus. So it's an extremely difficult balance to strike. And a particular point of tension here in California was that the USC, the university, cancelled the speech of the valedictorian. So that's the top graduate of the year, because she was accused of anti-Semitic comments. So they shut down her speech and cancelled some other speakers. And then that too helps to inflame tensions with protesters. There's people here holding placards, not just about the general issue of the war in Gaza, but actually about the valedictorian speech being cancelled too. So on an individual level, the action that campuses and universities are taking, it's very difficult for them to get the balance right in each place.
Emma Vardy at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. And we'll have more on the conflict in Gaza later in the podcast. After President Biden signed the long-awaited military aid package to Ukraine into law, he said military assistance would be sent to Ukraine within hours. He told reporters that the aid, worth $61 billion, would make the world a safer place.
This weekend, the reports, I find this amazing, the reports of cheers breaking out of the trenches in eastern Ukraine as they watch the House vote in support for Ukraine. Not like they don't understand what we've done. Not like they don't understand how critical this is for them. I'm making sure the shipments start right away. In the next few hours, literally in a few hours, we're going to begin sending in equipment to Ukraine for air defense munitions, for artillery, for rocket systems and armored vehicles.
In his nightly video address, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky said the support would help sustain his country's fight against Russia's invasion.
Цими днями вже максимально активно працювали з нашими американськими друзями.
These days, we have been working as hard as possible with our American friends at all levels to quickly fill this package from the United States with exactly the kind of weapons that our soldiers need, from army tactical missile systems and artillery, from anti-tank weapons and high-mobility artillery rocket system missiles, to much-needed air defense and equipment. I am grateful to President Biden and Congress, to all Americans who feel the need to knock the ground out from under Putin's feet.
Що потрібно вибивати землю з-під ніг у Путіна.
Anastasia lives in Kharkiv in the northeast of Ukraine, about 30 kilometers from the border with Russia. It has suffered frequent Russian airstrikes. She told us what she thought about the prospect of the arrival of more U.S. arms.
I am very careful and cautious about this. Because there's been a lot of talk and a lot of speculation and a lot of waiting. And maybe I will feel a bit better once I know that it's here, actually, because of how long it takes for something actually to get here and for the population to feel that something is improving. So I guess no one dares hope and feel happier until the moment they see something that is just helping people, see people suffering less, see less destruction. So we are hopeful, but very cautious about this.
So how much is this package likely to change events on the ground? I've been speaking to our security correspondent, Frank Gardner.
It will make a difference, but it's not going to win Ukraine the war. And I think it's important to have a bit of reality check. It's a massive relief to Ukraine because without this so-called supplementary aid package, Ukraine was quite possibly going to lose this war this year, or at least find it very hard to repel a Russian advance that could take Kharkiv or advance almost as far as the Dnieper. Now, that's an extreme case, but they were really hard pushed. They lack something that Russia has got, mass. And what this aid package will do is replenish those Ukrainian stocks in air defense missiles. Russia has been absolutely pummeling Ukraine with a combination of drones and missiles, and over 8,000 of these glide bombs. These things are wreaking havoc on the front lines. They're old converted Soviet dumb bombs that have been fitted with fins and GPS that then are launched from Russian territory and glide up to 40 kilometers towards Ukrainian positions. And these things are carrying up 3,000 kilos of high explosive. Now, you can be the best Ukrainian super soldier in the world with the best modern NATO kit. You're not going to survive a hit on your position with that.
Obviously, there's been a massive delay in this package. How damaging has that been to Ukraine?
critically damaging. It was getting to the point just before this where Ukrainians were starting to mutter some pretty dark words about the United States, because about feeling abandoned, that the US had turned its back on them, all because this hardcore Republicans were blocking this, the passage of this bill. But that has now passed. But in the meantime, Russia has taken over 500 square kilometers of territory. That's a lot. It's significant. And they were threatening places that would give them access to some of the really big strategic cities in the east. I mean, I don't think anybody was talking about Kyiv being overrun, but nevertheless, it was a very dangerous time. 6 months have been lost in this. And remember that Ukraine just wants to get this over with. I know it's a popular thing in the West to say, oh, you know, why don't they just do a peace deal? Ukrainians have got no appetite for that because, A, they don't trust Russia, and B, a peace deal would mean letting President Putin hang on to not only Crimea, but all the territory they've seized so far and illegally annexed. And they just think that Russia will simply use a peace deal to rearm, replenish, and come back and gobble up the rest.
If it doesn't help them win the war, do you think this will have an enormous effect on the morale? We heard President Biden saying there were people cheering on the front lines.
Yes, it's got a massive effect on Ukrainian morale. Some people have even compared it to when America came into the war on the side of the Allies in December 1941. This is a huge package, very significant, and it breaks down really into three areas: air defence, artillery, and rockets, so missiles. So all of that are the essential ingredients to the way this war is fought. So what they've been doing in trying to overwhelm Ukrainian defences is to send a whole load of these very cheap, mass-produced Iranian-designed Shahid drones, which will then confuse or take up the attention of Ukraine's air defence radar, and then follow it up with bigger missiles, cruise missiles, sometimes even ballistic missiles, to try and catch the enemy off guard. So this package will allow Ukraine to deal with that threat. It's not going to eliminate it, but it will make it easier.
Our security correspondent, Frank Gardner. One of the Western concerns during the Ukraine war has been the support that Russia's been receiving from China. Today, the American Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, began a visit to China as the US ramps up pressure on its rival over that support, while also seeking to manage tensions with Beijing. Our State Department correspondent, Tom Bateman, is travelling with Mr. Blinken.
Antony Blinken started his trip at a basketball match, almost too close to call as the Shanghai Sharks lost by a single point to the Zhejiang Golden Bulls. This moment, featuring the US delegation in a crowd of Chinese sports fans, was supposed to show cultural connections on a trip whose backdrop has instead been crackling with political tensions and rivalry. Both sides are keen for now to stabilise the US-China relationship in an increasingly uncertain and dangerous world. Mr. Blinken will spend a day in Shanghai, then fly to Beijing, where he will urge Foreign Minister Wang Yi to curb Chinese exports of machine tools and microchips to Russia. The US says the components are being used to make weapons for the war in Ukraine. It calls China the primary contributor to Russia's military-industrial base. Beijing calls that a groundless accusation and American hypocrisy days after Congress voted to send billions of dollars in lethal assistance to Kyiv. There'll also be talks about avoiding confrontation in the South China Sea and the Taiwan Strait, and about a path to peace in the Middle East. At the same time, there's distrust and a series of disputes about trade and about the export of Chinese chemicals helping to fuel America's synthetic opioid crisis. It is barely a year since the US shot down a suspected Chinese spy balloon over American waters, causing relations to sour. An American photo opportunity at the Shanghai basketball might have been one way to try to soften Washington's image, but Chinese officials didn't join Mr. Blinken there. Instead, both sides see this as a moment for standing firm, what each accuses the other of having made an unlevel playing field.
Our State Department correspondent, Tom Bateman. Meanwhile, TikTok could be banned in the US as a result of a measure backed by the US Senate. The social media app's Chinese owners have said they'll challenge the order in court. Meanwhile, TikTok is suspending the rewards program on its Lite app while it addresses concerns that it could be addictive, especially for children. The European Union had launched an investigation into the feature. Chris Vallance reports.
The rewards program in the TikTok Lite app, which recently rolled out in France and Spain, allows users to earn a few pennies a day in the form of vouchers, gift tokens, or tips to other TikTokers in return for watching videos. But the European Union said it would suspend the app if TikTok failed to convince it was safe. Now, a day before threatened action, TikTok has voluntarily suspended the rewards program while it addresses the EU's concerns. The firm has always denied it was addictive and says it's not available to under-18s and has daily limits on video watch tasks. EU industry chief Thierry Breton said investigations would continue, warning, "Our children are not guinea pigs for social media."
Chris Vallance. Now to a tale of alleged murder, rape, forced evictions and elephants. It all centres on the Ruaha National Park in Tanzania, the biggest park in East Africa and home to the country's largest concentration of elephants. As a result of serious allegations of abuse, the World Bank has suspended a massive $50 million of investment into expanding the park, which is located in southern Tanzania. Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, told me what prompted the World Bank to take this action.
Well, this story's been rumbling along for quite a while. Last year, a US-based think tank called the Oakland Institute came out with a report that made a series of allegations, some of which were concerning what's going on in that very park, and included allegations that some of the people who were living in the park were basically being forced out in different ways through the use of violence and through forcing their cattle away from the park so that they'd have to leave as well. But they also included in their report allegations of rape by some of the rangers who were working in the park who have benefited from some of this World Bank funding, and also allegations of some deaths as well inside the park. So a long series of allegations. Then the World Bank said they were going to look into them. And then just this week, they've now said, well, we've looked into them and they're so serious and we are not going to pay any more into this fund, which total was supposed to be 150 million. But as you say, 50 million still to be paid.
And what's the Tanzanian government said about this?
Well, the Tanzanian government has come out with a fairly straightforward statement, just saying we deny all of these allegations. Our government is not behind any of these abuses. It hasn't, for instance, talked about any kind of investigation that it wants to carry out, but it simply said that the expansion of this park, and it's supposed to be doubling in size, it said that project is still going to go ahead despite the fact that this funding's been frozen.
Do you think this is a part of a pattern of putting tourism ahead of local people's rights in Tanzania?
Well, that's what some human rights groups are saying, because this is not the first time that there have been a controversy over plans to expand a park. Some listeners might remember hearing about the Maasai community being forcefully evicted from another park further north. And again, the government denied that it was carrying out abuses and kicking people off that land. But several human rights groups came out with multiple reports, including evidence from villagers who said they were the subject of abuse and they were being forced off that land in order for the park to be expanded so that more tourism money could come in.
Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross. Still to come in this podcast, a popular Iranian rapper. He's been sentenced today to death. We ask why.
I was drawn to the mountains even as a little girl, simply out of a passion and a desire to move around in nature.
Five mountaineers with the same personal goal, to be the first woman to climb all 14 of the world's highest peaks.
I wanted to push myself to the limit.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their inspiring story.
You find something inside you to continue.
Our own strength.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now, the US aid package we were talking about earlier in connection with Ukraine also included $26 billion of military aid to Israel and $1 billion $1 billion in humanitarian assistance for Gaza. On Wednesday, Israeli officials again confirmed they're moving ahead with plans for a military assault on the southern Gazan city of Rafah, despite the United States' disapproval. More than 1 million Palestinians are currently sheltering there. There are reports that Israel has bought tents for civilians who'll need to be moved when an offensive on Rafah takes place. Here's the Israeli government spokesman, David Mentzer.
I've seen those reports, and I won't be making any comment on the numbers or whatever it is. But needless to say, we have acquired shelters for people because we don't want, our battle is not with ordinary Gazans. We want to move them out of harm's way. Our battle is with the genocidal terrorist army of Hamas.
Meanwhile, the United States and the European Union have also added their voice to that of the UN by demanding an investigation over reports of mass graves at the Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis. Peter Stano is a spokesperson for the European Commission.
We are gravely concerned by the reported discovery of mass graves in Khan Yunis and in Al-Shifa Hospital. This is something that forces us to call for an independent investigation of all the suspicions and all the circumstances, because indeed creates the impression that there might have been violations of international human rights committed. That's why it's important to have independent investigation.
Israel has denied allegations by officials in Hamas-run southern Gaza that its forces buried the bodies of Palestinians under a hospital courtyard. The Israel Defense Forces said it had opened existing graves while searching for the remains of hostages. It described reports that they buried bodies as baseless and unfounded. After more than 6 months of war, the impact of the conflict on the economies of Israel and the Palestinian territories has been significant. While nearly all economic activity in Gaza has been wiped out, the World Bank says the war has also badly hit businesses in the Palestinian West Bank. And as Wira Davis reports, Israel's much-vaunted status as the start-up nation is also under pressure.
I'm in the old city of Jerusalem, walking down the Via Dolorosa. At this time of year, there would be tens of thousands of tourists here, pilgrims visiting the holy sites. But it's eerily quiet. A few of the tourist shops are opening, but dozens of them have remained closed.
I'm Zach Mushriki, and I'm owner of a business inside the old city of Jerusalem. I sell mostly antiquities and biblical coins.
What is business like at the minute?
Only online, but physical people, no, we don't have. You know, the last week, you know, after the Iran-Israel escalation, just dropped it down again.
The old city is in occupied East Jerusalem. Just 68,000 tourists arrived in the region in February, according to Israel's Central Bureau of Statistics. That's down massively from 319,000 visitors in the same month last year. But it's not just in Jerusalem's holy places that they need a miracle.
My name is Ofer Moskowitz, and I'm in charge of this orchard of Kibbutz Misgavah.
Around 150 miles north of Jerusalem, on Israel's volatile border with Lebanon, clashes with Hezbollah have closed much of the area. Agriculture, like avocado farming, is another small but visible part of the economy that has been hit hard.
90% of them fell down.
The 90% of this crop, of that tree, has fallen down?
Yes. And you can see it. I must go to pick the fruits. It's very important to the next season. And I'm losing a lot of money because I can't pick.
In the coastal city of Tel Aviv, you'd be forgiven for occasionally forgetting that Israel is embroiled in its longest war since independence in 1948. Families make the most of the early summer sun to play in the surf, and young people relax near the beach. That way forever. Last week, the ratings agency S&P Global cut Israel's long-term forecast, reflecting a loss of market confidence after 6 months of war. Many Israelis, though, say the country's renowned high-tech and start-up sectors are proving to be more war-proof than expected.
In the first quarter of this year, almost $2 billion was invested in Israeli startups.
John Medved is founder and CEO of the global venture investment platform rCrowd.
We're having one of the best years we've ever had. And all of the big major corporations are here and are going nowhere. Not a single multinational has closed its operation in Israel since the war.
Elise Brezis is a professor of economics at Bar-Ilan University here in Tel Aviv. She says the full economic impact of the war may not yet have been felt.
Yes, we have a reduction in exports, but we had also a reduction in imports. So in fact, the balance of payment is still okay.
If the outlook in Israel is mixed, then across the separation barrier that divides Jerusalem from Bethlehem, the view from the Palestinian side is overwhelmingly bleak.
This is the first chairman for our Chamber of Commerce in 1952.
Dr. Sami Hasboun is chairman of Bethlehem's Chamber of Commerce and Industry. There's huge dependence and reliance on Israel's economy here. And while Gaza's economy has been completely destroyed by the war, here in the landlocked Palestinian West Bank, the almost complete closure of the separation barrier has had a disastrous impact, says Dr. Hasboun.
Bethlehem Governorate now, it's closed. There was around 16,000 to 20,000 Palestinian workers from our area working in Israel. Immediately they lost their income. You can imagine the impact on the economy. And in June, I'm expecting around 30,000 new graduates from the Palestinian universities. What they will do?
Unlike in some parts of Israel, where there is optimism around being able to ride out the storm and continue attracting investors, in the Palestinian West Bank and Gaza, there's little hope things will return to any kind of normal.
Ira Davis reporting from Israel and the West Bank. Now let's hear from what some people consider to be the world's bravest rapper. Toomaj Salahi is an Iranian hip-hop star who dedicated a lot of his music to the nationwide protest launched in 2022 after the death of Mahsa Amini in police custody. He was arrested in the same year, but on Wednesday he was sentenced to death. I asked Baron Abbasi of BBC Persian TV about the case.
He faced a number of charges, including corruption on earth. It's a vaguely worded charge, and the government usually uses it against its critics. It's based on Sharia law, and it carries the death penalty. He was sentenced to death, but the Supreme Court rejected that sentence. He was sentenced to 6.5 years in prison. Was released on bail in October 2023. Once he was released, he released a video detailing his treatment in prison, and he said that he was tortured. 11 days later, he was arrested again. And it seems that a lower court has reopened the case and reissued the death penalty, saying that it is exercising its independence.
So is it possible that it will be overturned again by the Supreme Court and it won't actually be carried out?
There is a possibility. His lawyer has said that they definitely plan to appeal.
And how are Iranians inside and outside of the country likely to react to this?
It has already come as a shock to his fans and many Iranians around the world because the death penalty was rejected in the first place. Nobody expected it to be reissued. BBC Persian TV spoke to his uncle who lives in Germany. He was also very angry and very disappointed, saying that this is a warning by the Islamic Republic to the youth not to challenge its authority. And he asked all Iranians around the world, especially the Iranian diaspora, to take to the streets and to raise awareness about how the Iranian government is treating its critics.
Baron Abbasi of BBC Persian TV. To Portugal now, where the country's president, Marcelo Rebelo de Sousa, surprised some when he announced Portugal takes full responsibility for its role in transatlantic slavery and suggested that there was a need for reparations to be paid. In an unexpected statement, the president said his country needed to repair the damage caused by its colonial past. Historically, Portugal had a long involvement in the slave trade, transporting around 6 million Africans across the Atlantic between the 15th and 19th centuries. The BBC's Celia Hatton asked Professor Pedro Cardim from Nova University in Lisbon for reaction to the president's comments.
I was surprised because I know that not long ago, we did not hold this opinion. For instance, He emphasized that the Portuguese had been the first Europeans to abolish the slave trade, which was actually even true, and preferred to underscore this positive image of the Portuguese imperial past. There's also sectors of the left who considered inappropriate to address these issues. And just to give an example, the former Portuguese prime minister, a socialist, even stated that discussing the imperial past was threatening to our identity, quote unquote.
So a significant about-face then. Can you just tell us, what was Portugal's role in transatlantic slavery?
Portugal was opening up these new routes of trade between southern Europe and many areas of sub-Saharan Africa. And later, in the first decades of the 16th century, Portugal expanded this trade to the Americas. It became the first nation to supply Spanish Empire with the labor force of thousands of enslaved Africans. And it remained the only European nation deeply engaged in this trade until, I would say, the 1630s, 1640s, the time when the Dutch and then the French and the English and also other European nations got more involved. Which means that the relationship that Portugal has with the transatlantic slave trade is one of the pioneering, so to say, and it lasted for several centuries. It is actually the longest involvement in the transatlantic slave trade among the various European nations involved in this terrible trade.
Okay, so given this vast history, what kind of reparations could be made?
To begin with, I think reparation means apologizing, just like other European leaders have done. So,
apologizing is important, but what other things could be done? Are there any payments that could be made? Are there objects that could be returned, for example?
Yeah, objects. Studying the provenance of colonial artifacts in Portuguese collections is, I think, absolutely necessary. And also discussing the return of those that are proven to result from looting and other more important objects. Also important is to cease to use public funds to finance initiatives that celebrate the so-called discoveries, that is to say, this enduring positive image of the Portuguese imperial past. And it's absolutely fundamental to promote the discourse about imperial past that is more just, more frank, and more plural. And above all, those who are the descendants of those who suffered most from Portuguese colonial domination.
Professor Pedro Cardim from Nova University in Lisbon. Nowadays, the prevalence of social media in most people's lives would suggest that people are generally very keen to keep contact with new acquaintances or seek out old friends. But new research suggests otherwise. James McCarthy reconnected with his best friend from childhood by chance at a Liverpool football match after being out of touch for more than 50 years.
I've had a season ticket for many years, and there's a stranger sitting next to me, and he's quite quiet, about 68. I show him my social media, and then he sees my surname, and he said, "Did you go to Cardinal Allen Grammar School in Liverpool?" I go, "Yeah." He says, "James, it's me, Colin." And he was my best friend from school. When we got to 16, I stayed on for A-levels. And a few weeks later, I get a letter from Colin from London. He said, "I've moved down here," and he doesn't put his address on it. And that's how we lost touch, can you believe? And we just feel we've got so much catching up to do. We had so much in common.
In fact, research from the University of Sussex in England found that people are just as likely to speak to a stranger, as James thought he was doing, as they are to get back in touch with an old friend, even when they want to see the friend and know they'd been happy to hear from them. Dr. Gillian Sandstrom is the psychologist behind the research.
We found over and over across lots of different studies, just how reluctant people are to reach out to an old friend. Because in many ways, we seem to feel like we're better than average. We feel like we're better than average drivers. We're more honest than other people, etc. But in terms of social skills, it seems to be an exception. We seem to feel like we're not any good at those. We feel like we don't know how to chat with people. We think people don't like us as much as we like them. And so, you know, in terms of reaching out to people, we worry a lot that they won't want to hear from us, that it'll feel awkward, and we might feel a bit guilty for losing touch with them.
I mean, it does seem extraordinary because some of these researches show that sometimes people would be reluctant even when they knew the person would be happy to hear from them.
Exactly, yeah. And so we tried lots of things to try to encourage people to reach out. We found that people want someone to reach out to them. They just don't want to be the one to initiate. So there's research showing that people appreciate it more than you even expect. But still, we could only get about a third of people to push send on a message that they'd already typed to someone that they thought would appreciate it. They just still would not do it.
That reluctance, did you look at how you could overcome the reluctance that people feel?
So I've done a lot of research on talking to strangers. And of course, you know, a lot of us feel really kind of anxious about that. And I ran a study involving a scavenger hunt where I asked people to talk to a stranger every day for a week. And what I found is having that practice, the repeated practice, really made a difference. So we adapted that to the reaching out situation. And we found that if people practice the behavior that's involved in reaching out, which is just sending messages. So if people send messages to people that they're already friends with, then they felt a bit more comfortable just doing the same thing with someone that they lost touch with.
Okay. Have you been practicing what you are preaching?
You know what? Since doing this work, now, anytime someone comes to mind and I think, oh, you know, I wonder how so-and-so is doing. I haven't been in touch for a while. I will literally stop what I'm doing and type a message. And I think we get stuck in our heads thinking it has to be the perfect message and I need a lot of time. And I'll just stop what I'm doing, type one sentence or two sentences, push that button. And I know that I'm, you know, doing an act of kindness.
Dr. Gillian Sandstrom speaking to Sarah Montague. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Ablakwa. The producer was Marion Strawn. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Rachel Wright. Until next time, goodbye.
I was drawn to the mountains even as a little girl, simply out of a passion and a desire to move around in nature.
Five mountaineers with the same personal goal, to be the first woman to climb all 14 of the world's highest peaks.
I wanted to push myself to the limit.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their inspiring story.
You find something inside you to continue.
Our own strength.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.